basically, as this is loading, I'm going to talk about Medicaid patients in our academic chiropractic clinic at New York Chiropractic College. Obviously, Medicaid patients are not your standard patient, and this is really interesting for us to go through. Dr. Napoli, who is the co-author on this, is here as well, and just want to thank him and also thank New York Chiropractic College for the support. Just to briefly give a little bit of background, I know I'm like the last presentation of the day. Medicaid, we're going back to 1965. It's a joint-funded program. Interestingly, and so the federal government supplies some funding, the state supplies some funding, and it leads to some interesting facts about Medicaid. It's extraordinarily flexible at the state level. States can decide who's eligible. They can decide what programs they're going to fund or not fund. They can decide how the program actually operates. It's very flexible state to state. It is also the largest funder of health care for America's poorest. And so we're talking about very low socioeconomic status. And some researchers looked at demographics of chiropractic patients, which would indicate these aren't necessarily the people we usually see. So this, again, was very interesting. Just a little background on how low socioeconomic status we're talking about. This is the New York eligibility requirements. A family of five could make like $13,000 a year. So we're talking about the very poor. Medicaid spending, like all healthcare spending in the United States, is increasing, but it's not increasing for chiropractors. Medicaid pays for 1.8% of chiropractic visits nationally. That is an unchanged figure from 1998 to 2003. So again, these are not, at least, of course, Medicaid is, these are not our patients. New York is one of 17 states that has absolutely no reimbursement for chiropractic, so one in three states don't have any. Taking this down to Seneca County, which is where New York Chiropractic College is located, we have a population of 33,000, of whom 4,000 are on Medicaid, and 11.5% of the population does live below poverty level. These patients are treated at the Campus Health Center, which is on the campus. There's no charge for Medicaid patients to come and receive care. They're treated by eight trimester students who are just starting their clinical year. And the clinic has begun to reach out to the county to help them be aware that these services are available. Dr. Napoli is on the Health Advisory Committee in the county and on Long-Term Care Portal of Entry. I'm serving on the Board of Health in our county. We've really tried to reach out and let the county know that these services are available. It turns out there's really not a great deal of research about Medicaid patients and chiropractic specifically. And NYCC approved two studies. One is a retrospective review, which is what I'm going to talk about today. The other is a prospective study to be carried out. So the review, and this is similar to the VA study that Dr. Dougherty reported, we're going to talk about all adult Medicaid patients in the academic clinic before January 1st. There were 129 total Medicaid files in the clinic. We couldn't use 40 of them, mostly because they were minors, and we said we were going to look at adults. We looked at 50 variables per patient. So it was when we combed through these files, we recorded a lot of data. It's a pretty rich set. And as I go through the presentation, we used chronic over 12 weeks, acute less than or equal to 16 days, and I'll use these terms somewhat interchangeably. So here they are. The basic demographics. These Medicaid patients were, on average, 37. But just like when we looked at the VA, the average patient was obese. And when you look at socioeconomic status and obesity, they're positively correlated in developed nations. The inverse is not as true sometimes in undeveloped nations. But there was certainly, with this low socioeconomic status, a strong obesity connection. Just as Gerald reported in his, we also had about 60% female, which does correlate strongly with national surveys, what percentage of the patients are female. Duration of symptoms. You can see over here on these columns, subacute and acute, about the same, but when you look at this chronic, the chronic pain connection of low socioeconomic status has been studied by many researchers. A relationship is certainly there between chronic pain and low socioeconomic status. It is not clear whether pain causes you to have low socioeconomic status or vice versa. However, the relationship is certainly there and was borne out in this study. When we look at where these 88 patients had their complaints, 56 had any low back pain, 40 neck pain, 19 headache. As we break it down, and the low back complaints, 37 was only low back, 6 included pain above the knee, and 13 below the knee. When we go out to neck pain complaints, 31 was neck pain only, 9 had upper extremity pain, and 14 had headache. These numbers differ substantially from the NBCE survey, where they said on average 24% of patients were there for low back complaints. We had 64. Neck complaints are 18, we had 45. And headache 12. Headache and facial pain 12. This is headache only was 22%. So rather different figures in the socioeconomic group that we saw versus national. Now just looking at this column here on the left, patients could check whether or not they'd had prior treatment. Blue is if they'd had physical therapy or rehab for their chief complaint. Red is if they'd had some form of medical treatment for their chief complaint. It's not clear from the study what that was, but we just know that they had some form of prior treatment, many of them already. earlier conversation about this. But anyway, we did compare state of pain at intake, and they're drawn. It was actually drawn on a VAS at intake, and it turned out that they were very, very similar. 6.0 on, you know, verbally tell me what's your pain out of 10 versus drawn. They came in basically identically. Comorbidities. We had 43% of our Medicaid patients reported that they were smokers. Nationally, only 20% of adults smoke. And even if you just look at adults in poverty, nationally 30% of adults in poverty smoke. So we had far higher than the reported statistics. Interestingly, 57% of the acute patients smoke. So the chronic and subacute patients, it was about this 40%. So there is certainly a connection to be worth exploring, and others have on tobacco use and smoking and on pain. It was much more prevalent among our acute patients. As we look at depression, half of our patients reported that they had it. Again, the national figures are 17.7% for depression and 18% for anxiety. Even if these numbers here are mutually exclusive, which we know there's some overlap in patients, that would still only add up to about 36%. And you compare that to our, in essence, 50% reported depression, much higher. Now the drawback, as Paul mentioned on PTSD with those patients, we don't know if they were actually medically diagnosed with depression. They checked on the box that it was one of their comorbidities. We don't know if it was medical diagnosis. In contrast with smoking, depression was evenly distributed among acute, subacute, and chronic patients. Now this is interesting because other research tends to show that depression has some correlation with chronic pain. It was not found here. And the suspicion is the correlation in this study was between socioeconomic status and depression. Every patient was very poor, and depression was very common regardless of their pain status. Just as was shown earlier in the VA study, a highly comorbid population, the average patient had a lot going on. We also looked at osteoporosis and Coumadin and Plavix use in these patients, and just as was reported in the VA study, we had no serious adverse events in any of those patients. So how were they treated? Up here we have an N of 83. We had 5 patients that didn't complete intake, so they never had a treatment plan. Of those who had plans developed, 81 included soft tissue, 73 HVLA, 6 activator, and 32 flexion distraction. If you combine all the manipulative techniques, you have 77 had some form of joint manipulation in the treatment plan. This was different than NBCE. As we compare these two columns, we had 88% receive HVLA, 71 nationally, 39 flexion distraction, 23 nationally, and 7 for activator versus 24%. So just very different treatment plans in this population and with our particular students and clinicians. Did the patients report soreness after the first treatment? 77% did not. Now, we might have expected more soreness. There are other studies such as Hurwitz say, you know, 36% may have some adverse event. And he was just looking at neck pain patients, and ours was not strictly neck pain. We also were doing an administrative review. The clinician may not have asked if they got sore, and it may not have been written down. However, we could tell from almost all those notes. Only 8% is unknown. So we were surprised by that finding, but that's what we had. When you look at how they responded to their first treatment, 50 out of 73 were better at all after the first treatment, which was a very satisfying finding, again, considering the chronicity of the complaints that the patients had. And when we look overall through the course of their treatment, again, the patients came in with a fairly substantial amount of pain. We look at that blue line and we know acute patients get better, and they did. But also when you look at the subacute and chronic patients, we had a fairly substantial improvement as we went throughout and even looked out at 4 to 6 weeks. Still a short-term follow-up, but the effect at 4 weeks was relatively present still at 6 weeks, at 4 to 6 weeks. Excuse me, effective treatment for compared to 4 to 6 weeks. Likely a clinically meaningful improvement, though we'd have to do more study on that, but they did have a drop in 4 on their verbal numeric rating scale, which was 0 to 10 in integers. Okay, it could be clinically important. This one's an interesting one. We looked at how many treatments they had to have to get at least 50% better. So obviously they had to be treated at least once, so we're excluding the 15 patients who never completed a first treatment. We also aren't including patients for whom we could not tell if they got better or worse. We were only using NRS, the verbal NRS data, and if it wasn't recorded in the file, we couldn't tell if they got better or worse. But of those whom we could tell, 77% reported at least 50% improvement in a mean of 4 visits. And that was basically true regardless of their pain status, which I also thought was very interesting. It was very, very similar. Now, as far as the limitations on the study go, most of them have been talked about already by myself and also Paul in his study, but it was a retrospective review. It's a complete convenience sample. We only saw patients who came in, and I can't talk about other Medicaid patients. It was an administrative review, so what wasn't in the file wasn't in the file, and it's missing. But as far as what we can say, it appeared to be effective pain management in the short term for most of the patients in this study. As we look to the future, obviously the prospective study we want to do with care to include all of the data that we want to track. It's a rich data set, and we'd love to, and we also have a grant proposal in to get the money to do a very multivariate analysis on these 50 covariates to see if you can predict which, for example, chronic pain patients are likely to respond. Cost effectiveness, I mean, we did see a fairly strong response as far as pain management went, and yet we're in a state that Medicaid does not cover chiropractic. So as far as a policy implication goes, there's certainly study that can be done there in these patients. And also, as Paul mentioned in his, the idea of integrated team management, to take behavioral health, to take chiropractic or manual medicine, to take allopathic medicine, to combine them all together and see if you can't provide these very comorbid patients with the very best possible care and actually see them to the best improvement.